This Writers' Centre Norwich recording features readings by writers invited to the 2015 World's Literature Festival. Find out more at writerscentrenorwich.org.uk.
My name's Kate Griffin, and this morning I'll be hosting a reading by two wonderful writers, Mario Martino and Kyoko Yoshida. We'll be crossing cultures and taken on a journey through various Central Asian states to a hybrid zone somewhere between reality and nightmare. Unfortunately, Chris Lee has had to cancel her own journey here to Norwich because the travel from Rome became a nightmare in itself due to strikes and other things, so apologies for that. But this morning we'll start with Marion Maltino. Marion's writing reflects the breadth of her life experience. She grew up in South Africa, where she was active in opposition to the apartheid regime. She lived in Zambia at a time of profound social change, has pioneered educational projects in multi-ethnic communities in the UK, and worked for Save the Children in many of the poorest areas of Asia and Africa. It's this experience with Save the Children that she draws on so very effectively in her latest book, Uncertain Light. The novel is set in Tajikistan, just after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and explores the world of an international aid organisation working with refugees and others who are dealing with the aftermath of conflict. In their different ways, the characters are all trying to make a connection with the world around them, while at the same time coming to terms with their own upbringings and life choices. They revolve around a central character, Rahul Khan, who was a man who could talk with anyone, crossing boundaries all the time, both inner and outer. Uncertain Light is a particularly apt novel to read at an international literary gathering like this, as it explores the importance of stories, poetry, and translation, reflecting Marion's own fascination with Urdu poetry and the poet Khalid. Marion.
Thank you. So that's what my book looks like. Is the microphone working? You can hear? Yeah. And this is how it begins. High in the mountains of war-torn Tajikistan, a charismatic UN peace negotiator is taken hostage, abducted. As hopes for his survival fade, those closest to him scattered around the world have to begin remaking their own lives. I'm going to give you glimpses into three of those lives in three very short readings. One is Lance, an English-Canadian who works for an aid agency moving from country to country, Rahul's closest friend. Another is Nargis, a Tajik woman, trying to respond to the crisis that's hit her country, economic collapse, civil war, poverty. The third is Tessa, an Irish woman, married with two children, but Rahul was her first love, and that love's never really ended. But this is how the story begins. You travel first through a flat valley, barren except for a trail of green that follows the bed of the river. The view is long, the space is wide and empty. All you'll see of human habitation is an occasional yurt, the squat round tent of a herder family, where sheep with long floppy ears and fat tails huddle together in the early morning mist. Ahead, the mountains loom, rising abruptly from the valley floor. Nearer, and the road begins to rise into an amphitheatre of gaunt hills, with tracks disappearing into small stands of forest. Up further, and the earth closes in as the road winds up the side of a steep valley with a dramatic drop to the river below. It's from here that the road becomes treacherous. You would never venture up it without a driver who knew it well. The tarmac has fallen apart. It hasn't been repaired since before the end of the Soviet era, and the earth beneath crumbles. Each time you round a steep bend, you expect calamity. But when you can forget about the road, you're caught by awe at the shape of the land. Look down, and it's all boulders and humpy earth, the remains of some long-ago landslide. Look up, and the road winds constantly upwards. Hard to imagine that new valleys will open up high above, or that this mountain is a mere foothill to the massive barriers beyond, the Pamirs that are called the roof of the world. You're touching ages past up here, for the road follows an ancient track that for centuries was a route over these mountains into China. But that fell into disuse longer ago than anyone can remember, and the Silk Road traders found less hazardous routes across. In recent times, it's had another function, for not far from here is a scarcely marked border with Tajikistan, a country so remote, so unconnected to the outside world, that few outsiders have registered its existence, let alone know that its people have endured a traumatic civil war. For those fleeing from the fighting, this was one possible route out. Difficult enough in a vehicle, arduous beyond imagination for those who had to do it on foot. If they succeeded, they would arrive in a high valley, a place called Sukhanovod. Rahul Khan was one of the few outsiders to have been there, sent by the UN's refugee agency to check out the situation of those who had fled. When he and his team got up there, they found over 3,000 new arrivals, mostly women and children, crammed into the villages and former collective farms. It was September. If nothing were done, they wouldn't survive the winter. Rahul had a month to get a camp up, supplies in, distribution systems in place, before the road became impassable. He had by then had years of experience of working with people displaced by civil war, first in Afghanistan, then in Tajikistan itself. But something unexpected happened to him in that brief encounter with a remote mountain valley. The place itself moved him, he told his friend Lance, beyond what he could explain. There are huge boulders up there, Rahul said, with strange markings on them that look as if the gods had rolled them down the mountainside, and here they landed eons ago. The markings could almost be a picture script, but if they are, no one has deciphered them. The people who live in those valleys shrug and say, they're just scratches in the rock. How will anyone ever know how they got there? But Rahul could not dismiss them so casually. Perhaps they had some religious significance, long ago religions that we know nothing of today, or told a story, a herder giving expression to his artistic soul while he watched his sheep. To Rahul, they represented something profound, a refusal of mortality. I exist, scratched the artist, the herder, the priest, perhaps the soldier who had been separated by blizzards from his army and wandered now alone in this valley, facing death by exposure and starvation. Today still I live, here, now, on this piece of earth. I align with this rock that is older than all imagination, that will survive the obliterating force of time to scratch some mark of my being here. I exist. What does death mean? One moment life is there, the next it is not. Images move around Lance, bizarre fragments from way back in childhood. A winter morning in his home in Lincoln, boyhood home, a mole he found dead behind a shed, its body frozen in an early frost, its small splayed feet pointing helplessly outwards. Meat on a butcher's chopping boards, the moment of discovery that they had once been sheep, cows, alive. A wild duck with an injured wing that he found by a lake in Canada and made a safe place for in an old boat shed. A creature he loved passionately as he cared for it, and then he came back one morning to find it dead. He wakes at 4 a.m. with the first Kathmandu temple bells. He pulls on a coat and leaves the house to walk the dark streets. He reaches Durbar Square and sits on the steps of an old building. He sits where he sat with Rahul the last time they were together. Bizarre in the half-light, the stone carvings of animals and gods begin to emerge. He hears Rahul's voice saying, in that light tone that disguised something serious, I love this place. It's got hallowed memories. Now Lance will never know what the memories were. The world is waking up. A woman appears with her children. He watches her prepare breakfast over a fire with her two little girls keeping a casual eye on a toddler who seems at some danger of falling into a ditch. A couple of boys arrive and start an impromptu football game with a Coke can. They're alive, these boys. In the face of death, all life seems miraculous. He watches them as if they hold the secret of how to stay living. There was a time when he lived with the same carefree elan these boys have. He and his friends would cycle out along the country lanes of Lincolnshire, dump their bikes at the edge of a field, scramble through hedges, shift stones to dam a stream. That was his place, as Kathmandu is theirs. But Kathmandu too has become his, and now his contract is almost up, and he's going to have to go. I can't go on doing this, he thinks. I can't keep on moving and rooting myself and then having to leave. I need a different life, somewhere in one place, with people who I know will be there at the end of the month, the year, 3 years. Men start work on one of the temples, repairing stonework. Bells ring. People walk purposefully across the square. The noise of traffic in the streets beyond begins to reach him, the city gearing up for the working day. They're all getting on with life. Busy. Normal. Rahul is dead, and everything here goes on as it did yesterday. Nargis, Tajikistan. A child in front of her. A girl child, bedraggled from living on the streets. A child of about 9, 10, no older, she must be older, look at her eyes. It could be Layla looking at her, but putting such distance between them. Right here, yet unreachable, her eyes giving no sign of feeling other than a now habitual calculation, what can I get out of this person? When the question comes, it's like an echo of something Nargis has heard before the child says it. Have you got any money? No. It's instinctive self-protection, knowing she needs to save what she has for food for the household. But her brain is tearing at her, saying, Allah, forgive me, this is my own child. And then the child's eyes shift, and she begins to wonder whether it really is Layla, and feels overcome that she cannot be sure. Her face is so changed, but how would it not be changed, the life she's leading? Not just the eyes, but the face hollowed out of permanent hunger, the skin calloused and dirty. She can't even be sure now whether the child is a girl, but deep hormonal knowledge tells her that this child is hers. Love aches in her guts and leaves her mind fuzzy, barely coping with the pain of knowing she's doing this all wrong. Desperate to put it right, she reaches into her purse and starts saying, here, take this. It is too late. The child has gone. Soundless, alley cat disappearance. The sense of loss is overpowering. Why hadn't she said, come home, there's food in the house and a warm place to sleep and so much love always there for you? Why? She turns to run down the streets, desperate to find the child and hold on to her. And suddenly, there at the end of the road is Khalid. He's climbing into a waiting car. The car is coming right past her. She has to stop him, get him to help her find Layla. If she jumps into the road, the car will have to stop. It gets nearer. The driver swerves to avoid her and drives on. She sees the back of Khalid's head as the car passes, and he never once looks at her. She turns to see Rahul standing there, quietly observing it all. He says, I can see it's difficult for you. Perhaps I should stay away. And then he too is gone. She wakes, sweating, whimpering uncontrollably. And with waking reality comes the anger she cannot free herself from. Khalid should be here, helping to keep their child safe in a world in which nothing that they grew up taking for granted can any longer be relied on. As the anger retreats, an undercurrent of misery types back fiercely. About Khalid, the old Khalid who is lost to them all. About Rahul, wishing they had never met. She waits until that too has washed over her. Then slowly, as if her joints ache, she moves to get out of bed and face the day, to pack her feelings away so they will not show in her face, will not alarm Layla, who is sleeping in a small bed in the same room, will not distress her mother-in-law, as together they get food ready in the kitchen, will not get in the way of her work when once she gets into the office. Tessa, in Ireland. When they've got the children to bed, she says to Ben, "I don't know what's got into me, I have to get out. I'm going for a walk." "In the dark?" "Just down the lane, I'll take the torch. Come here first." She goes over to where he sits on the sofa. He puts out his hand to pull her down to sit next to him, his arm around her, and holds her close. She nestles up against his shoulder, wanting to cry. She feels weighed down by all the complications she's landed him with these last 6 years. He holds her. "I'm sorry, Tessa, about everything. Forget it. We just have to get through this time and it'll start getting easier. If you're going for a walk, I'll come out with you. We can leave the kids for a short while." "No, no, I won't feel comfortable leaving them. I'll go on my own. I won't be long." It's unexpectedly calming, being alone in the dark. Full moon, so she hardly needs a torch. She stands for a moment, taking in the small night sounds, letting herself become just another part of nature. So much Ben has had to cope with, and then he says sorry. She begins walking down towards the beach, moving carefully so that the crunch of her footsteps doesn't disturb the silence. She finds a sheltered corner next to a boat shed, looks out over the sea, travelling in her mind south to the tip of Ireland, and beyond that to the open ocean, other continents. She remembers another sea at another turning point in life, when she'd gone travelling to get away from Rahul. She had retreated to a beach resort in Thailand that her father had once taken the family to. She slept in a thatched hut on stilts and was woken before dawn by the long, slow, repetitive crash of the waves to take a solitary walk along the beach in the half-dark that, in looking back, acquired the quality of a rite of passage, a silent saying goodbye to any possibility of life with Rahul. She feels still the air on her skin, damp, warm, salty, the sensation of bare feet on the stilted walkway, and then as she jumped down off it, of the soft sand between her toes. The sea was just a dark space ahead with an occasional light bobbing up in it, but she sensed it getting nearer as the sand got firmer and wetter with each step. A dog emerged from the half light and trotted past her, nose down, not stopping to look. She watched it go, drip, 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 hitting straight for something unseen, a line of small footprints marking the wet sand and then disappearing as the water seeped back up. A rim of light touched the distant curve of the ocean horizon, pink now, getting lighter every second. By the time it was fully light, the magic had slipped away. What was she doing here? Everyone else had a purpose. The fishermen were busy with their nets. On the thatched veranda, the waiters moved around, setting the tables for breakfast. Even the other tourists had a plan, a sense of why they were here. She went back for paper and pen and found a place to sit, perched on a derelict, upturned boat, half lost under banana fronds, to write to Rahul. But what to write? She wanted to have something significant to tell him, a purposeful future to announce. She sat for a long time, staring out at the sea, seeing pictures of him in all moods, listening, indignant, amused, thoughtful, invigorating. He so driven, she so drifting. What was there to say to him? The pictures blurred through the waves. She began describing for him the early morning beach. She returns to the present. Ireland. It is night. It is the moon's light, not the sun's, that tips the shallow waves that wash towards her and out again, towards her, then out. The shushing of the waves washing up fragments of her past, then washing them back out again. And in the quiet rhythm of the night beach, she begins to feel, for the first time since Rahul's death, a trace of inner calm, touching and letting go, being reminded and then letting it slip away. Nothing that has happened is finished. The present moment is just the center of spinning time, with all our yesterdays and tomorrows circling around us. He is here, still, keeping her company as she adjusts to life without him, giving her courage to find her own way. "I want you to learn to fly," he said, "with your own wings." Thank you.
Thank you, Marion, for that beautiful reading. Our second reader this morning is Kyoko Yoshida. Kyoko teaches American literature in Kyoto and translates contemporary American writing into Japanese. She also translates experimental Japanese poetry into English, usually in collaboration with other translators. And her translation with Forrest Gander of Kyuai Nomura's Spectacle and Pigsty won the 2012 Best Translated Book Award in Poetry in the United States. Fascinated by the texture of language, Kyoko also writes her own prose in English, her second language. Her debut collection, the wonderfully titled Disorientalism, brings together 19 short stories that systematically smash the boundaries of the real and its imagining. Told with a deadpan, visceral humour, these stories unsettle and surprise the reader, leading us into alternate realities, at once comic and nightmarishly beautiful and human. And as her collaborator Forrest Gander says of her work, "Commonplace animals, dear reader, will never look quite the same to you."
Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Writers' Center, for bringing all of us together to this beautiful marriage. Presently, I am working on a novel. African Americans have been banned from the Major League Baseball until Jackie Robinson made his debut with the Brooklyn Dodgers on April 15, 1947. Before that, they had the Negro Leagues, the leagues of their own. They were the Negro World Series and the Negro All-Star Games, just like the white men's leagues. Negro Leaguers also traveled all over the United States and many parts of Central America with their barnstorming teams. Traveling in the Jim Crow era South was not easy. Many testimonies from former Negro Leaguers remain today, and these allow us to review the history of baseball. The novel I am working on is based on a barnstorming tour of the Philadelphia Royal Giants, an all-star Negro League team which has nothing to do with the eponymous city. In 1927, they crossed the Pacific and barnstormed Japan, including the Korean Peninsula, then under the imperial rule. And that was 7 years before Babe Ruth visited the country to prompt the foundation of professional baseball there. How did these African-American athletes travel in the era of class-conscious trans-Pacific passenger boats? It has turned out that they took a boat the Japanese government commissioned to ship poor Japanese farmers to Brazil. The boat, the La Plata Maru, was circumnavigating the globe westward, starting from Kobe and then to Singapore, Ceylon, and Durban. It dropped the farmers at São Paulo, replacing them with coffee beans, and it would stop over at New Orleans and Los Angeles before crossing the Pacific back to Japan. The reason why I am telling you about this novel is that, apart from sharing the story with you, I am going to read a short story from my collection, Disorientalism, and from the way I write, perhaps you may be able to imagine how difficult and hence, how difficult this new project is for me. Disorientalism consists of stories related to actual cities and specific places. These spaces are disorienting because they are half real and half imaginary. The collection also includes some animal fables that I personally call disappointing animals. The story I am going to read this morning, titled Squirrel Heaven, is both a part of the bestiary and the cityscape narrative. Squirrel Heaven. I've decided the reason why I've never seen a dead squirrel is that squirrels have a secret garden where they die, which, like a black hole, would instantaneously swoosh them into the squirrel heaven, where nuts and pizza crusts are abundant. But one day, I finally come across the dead squirrel, curled up in the grass at the foot of an oak tree near the Field Museum. The grass is a round patch, as though it has grown just to accommodate this squirrel's death. The squirrel has a dead face, a half-open eye, a dusty nozzle, and deteriorating gums. But the fur is still clean and the body undamaged. I take out my handkerchief, look around to see if anyone is watching, spread it next to the squirrel, brush the dirt off its face with a wisp of soft grass, scoop the body and wrap it up in a cloth, noting its diagonal edges. I do not put the wrap in my bag. I clutch the knots and carry it home like a purse heavy with silver coins. The rule is not to eat animal meat. The rule is not to kill. So, when we encounter a dead doe on the road, we express our gratitude to Earth and eat it. We must eat it so that life is not wasted. When we stumble upon a dead pigeon in the park, we thank heaven and pluck it. Thus, I've eaten rabbits, weasels, and raccoons, many birds whose names I don't know. But I've never eaten a squirrel because I haven't set eyes on a dead squirrel before. There are so many squirrels around, all of them alive, fat and fast and alive everywhere. I must confess that when we go without meat for weeks, I start dreaming about the sweet tenderness of squirrel flesh. So many times my mouth has watered at the sight of those November fat squirrel buttocks, but squirrels never came to us dead until I found one near the Field Museum. When I tell my mother I found a dead squirrel, she immediately gets herself busy. She sends my brother off for acorns. My father cuts its tail off as a keepsake and starts skinning and gutting the creature. I light some incense and ring the bell. When my brother comes back with a handful of acorns, we sit at the table together and crush their shells. The acorns are wrapped tightly in a piece of tea towel, and I hold onto the right tail of the towel, securing the wrap on the phone book for my brother to thump the nuts with the kitchen mallet. We both remain quiet, concentrating so as not to smash my fingers. Then the acorns are smeared with the fresh spices my mother has just ground in a mortar and stuffed into the squirrel's now hairless belly. While we wait, sitting at the table in front of the oven, we tell our squirrel stories to each other, occasionally ringing the bell. And it turns out it is the first time for any of us to have dead squirrel, except for my mother, who, as a child, grabbed the dead squirrel when she stuck her hand into a tree hole. It was early spring, my mother recalls, and the squirrel was still lukewarm, and its heart had stopped beating. It was a tiny, skinny squirrel. She remembers her mother put so many acorns in its hungry belly, it almost burst in the oven. I did once see a squirrel come close to death. This squirrel wanted to cross Belmont Street, dodging underneath an SUV, was nearly run over. The rear tire caught the tail fur, and the creature tumbled round and round in front of the running tire. I was the only pedestrian next to the car. I was ready to scream, my hands pressing against my face. No, not in front of my eyes. I won't be able to swallow the consequences. The squirrel rolled three times and finally dashed back to my side of the street, looking cute and stupid like any squirrel, like nothing had happened, and climb up an oak tree. That is the squirrel story I contribute. We each take a lamb or the neck and share the trunk together. I am surprised. It tastes exactly the way I imagined it would taste. But I did not imagine the small bones would be crunchy and edible. The acorns are the hardest to finish. Bitter, hard, and dry. We masticate without the word. Outside the window, my eyes search for life's girls. I dream of fluffy tails fast funambulating on the telephone wires in the backyard, but I see none. What if, my apprehension grows as I chew on, what if this is the beginning of the end? The beginning of an epidemic, for instance. What if we see no more life squirrels dashing around, sticking out their tails from dumpsters? What if all the squirrels we're going to come across from now on will be dead squirrels because I discovered the secret garden where they gather to die? A simple consequence. We will never worry about our food. We will eat nothing but squirrels for the rest of our lives. We will be overloaded with protein, so our piss will smell strange. My brother and I will have to gather acorns every day. Someday, my fingers will get smashed. And what if we cannot finish all the dead squirrels we find? It's been a while since we gave up our summer road trips. We just couldn't finish dozen road kills every day. Now we take planes and trains. The scriptures do not tell us what to do with surplus dead animals. Heaven has never rained dead squirrels upon us. I will bury the squirrel's skull under the round patch of the grass tomorrow. In the past, the rule applied to people too. The rule was universal. The scriptures value every form of life. When you set eyes on a dead grandmother, you did not waste her life. But as we moved to cities, it became difficult not to waste our dead. And the elders decided to make an exception. Consequently, I've seen a dead grandmother, but never eaten one. Now, if we keep finding too many dead squirrels, we may have to give up eating squirrels altogether, making it an exception. Then, the municipal hygiene office will organize regular cleanups of the squirrel corpses that perpetually materialize. Squirrel collection trucks will thread streets and alleys, chiming the squirrel collection music. Each truck will be equipped with dustpan and motorized broom. At stops, its rear lid will open up, producing the steel dustpan as wide as the truck itself on the ground, and the broom, or more of a huge deck brush resembling a baleen mustache, will come down to rake up the squirrel corpses, now a bunch of dusty fur balls tossed up with cigarette stubs and candy wrappers and crumpled pages of tabloid newspapers. When the lid flips open again, and the dustpan heavy with the carcass meat lifts, pedestrians will get the glimpse of the rodential purgatory flame, where the waste is tossed. In a flash, the lid will shut tightly before we actually see the fur catching fire, and off the truck will go to the next collection spot, resuming the merry music, the dirge to send the innocent off to heaven, and spewing crisp fumes into the air from its smokestack. The odor will tempt the heathens to grill meat for dinner, causing more lives to be wasted at the meat factories. We will have to witness squirrel lives and all sorts of other lives getting wasted. My heart throbs at the idea. It just doesn't sound right. We might have to move to a high-rise apartment downtown so as not to set eyes on the carcasses covering earth, but then that means the end of accidental meat consumption. We will all live meatless until a clueless bird jumbles itself in the ventilation system, which may or may not happen once in several years. The elders will prohibit us to play on the ground, so I will have to hang around with kids from the high rise, who are not the most sympathetic kind of people to begin with. We will have to take a special masked vehicle to go to school. We will have to scurry down our way whenever on the ground, averting our eyes from the truth, meaning that we too become hypocrites, like the heathens. Some people who've been making fun of us will ridicule us even more as we run down the street, and we will have to leave the city altogether someday.